Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Haldit. Coming up in a few minutes, Gabe Bullard reports on robocalls. First, Kentucky lawmakers did as they promised late last month. In one quick week, they passed a pension reform bill in a special session called by Governor Steve Beshear. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh covered the session.
In the chaos of the final hours of the 2008 regular session of the Kentucky General Assembly, a tentative agreement between House and Senate leaders on pension reform collapsed. But in May, with state retirement systems still facing a $27 billion unfunded liability, Governor Beshear urged legislative leaders to try again. In early June, they announced a new agreement, and the governor prepared to call a special session. On June 23rd, the session began with House Speaker Jody Richards surrendering his gavel to deliver a floor speech.
It is good news for all the citizens of this Commonwealth that the legislature is poised to pass pension reform. Pension reforms that will move us far down the road toward paying off the large unfunded liability of the systems.
Special sessions cost taxpayers about $60,000 a day, but legislative leaders promised Governor Beshear they could get the job done in 5 days. And by the end of the first day, a 179-page pension bill had cleared House committee. That night, Governor Beshear gave lawmakers a pep talk.
A quick and successful special session can signal the beginning of a new era in Frankfort, one where cooperation on critical public policy is the norm and where politics and partisanship are reserved for campaigns.
By the session's third day, the House was prepared to vote on the pension bill, which included a formula for reducing the unfunded liability. The bill, which mostly affects new hires, requires state employees to work longer before drawing benefits and prevents so-called double dipping. That's when a state employee retires, then finds another state job and begins building a second retirement. The bill drew strong praise from Frankfort Representative Derek Graham, who represents thousands of state employees.
House Bill 1 is an attempt to uphold the state's end of the bargain, to keeping the promises made to current employees and our retirees. But House Bill 1 is only the beginning.
Have all members voted? Clerk will take the roll. There being 98 members voting aye, no members voting nay, House Bill 1 is adopted.
The bill then moved to the Senate, where it again received quick committee action and was before the full Senate by the end of the week. Only one senator, Republican Tom Buford of Nicholasville, voted against it.
I expect under the provisions of this bill, by 2025, we will still have an unfunded liability of over $33 billion after what we vote on today. Now, I know it's been said this is a first step, but I don't know how long it's going to take us to walk to the moon, but that's a long trip.
There being 35 yeas and one nay, House Bill 1 is passed.
As promised, the special session was over in 5 days, and Governor Beshear quickly called a news conference to sign the bill into law. Among those standing behind him as he inked the document was Sylvia Lovely of the Kentucky League of Cities. She says the bill, which will save local governments $55 million in employer contributions this year, is a great beginning.
It's even more than a beginning because it brings the rates down in the first year, allows some of the reforms to start taking place, and then the hard work begins of working on some of the other issues.
Among those issues is the soaring cost of health insurance for retirees, which is under study by a special panel appointed by the governor. The group is also studying the feasibility of 401k-style benefit plans for state workers. Work group recommendations are due on the governor's desk by November 1st. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
Before the primary election last May, political advertisements filled newspapers and airwaves. That will also be the case as the general election approaches. But as WFPL's Gabe Bullard reports, candidates are finding other ways to reach out to voters. One method is coming under increased scrutiny, and in some states, is prohibited.
Have you come home to this?
You have one new message.
We're calling from United for Quality Care to tell you that now is the time to speak up for better care. There's a bill in the Senate.
If you have a landline telephone, it's a sound you'll probably be hearing between now and November. It's a robocall, and it's a popular tool for political campaigns.
It's an effective way to get a message out in a concise 30-second clip. Some people don't watch television, maybe don't listen to the radio, but everyone has a phone.
Brad Cummings is chairman of the Jefferson County Republican Party. He says candidates frequently use automated calls to get their message to voters, especially if the campaign's war chest is getting a bit lean.
You'll see a lot of the down-ticket candidates who have limited budgets, who have limited funds raised. They'll invest in the robocalls or autodialers for that particular reason.
But it's not just cash-strapped candidates using the calls. Congressman John Yarmuth employed the technology in his 2006 campaign and will do so again in his re-election bid this year.
Obviously, robocalls are less expensive to reach each person than even direct mail is.
Our retail is 15 cents per number for three attempts for a 30-second message.
Jerry Pizzette is the vice president of the Database Systems Corporation, an Arizona-based company that provides the technology for automated calls. He says because his business offers a more feature-rich robocall service, it's a little expensive. But he says it's worth it.
Typically, if you were to take a normal day, you could expect about 84% of the messages to be delivered.
Anyone in Kentucky can receive political robocalls. The Do Not Call registry only applies to telemarketers. But some states are extending the registry to cover political calls. Other states are banning them altogether, including New Hampshire, California, North Dakota, and Indiana.
I'm sure there are citizens of Kentucky who envy their neighbors across the Ohio River who have more peace and quiet.
Steve Carter is the Attorney General of Indiana. He's defending a challenge to the ban that was recently argued before the state Supreme Court. Political groups who oppose the ban say their political speech is being limited. Carter disagrees.
If we go back to the last couple campaigns and you ask citizens if they've received enough of it, what with the communications over the internet, over the telephone, through television, through radio, if you ask the average citizen whether their political speech has been restricted too much, I think they would say no.
There's been legislation floated to ban robocalls in Kentucky, but it hasn't passed. In the meantime, many local campaigns are keeping robocalls in their playbooks. Both Congressman Yarmuth and his opponent, Ann Northup, will or have used a variation of the teletown hall.
This is a new technology that allows thousands of people to participate over the phone in a town hall meeting. So I'm in my office in Washington, and we place automated calls to thousands of people, alerting them that I'm going to be doing this in a few minutes, and they can click through and participate in the meeting.
But Yarmuth does admit the calls can be irritating, and even robocall business owner Jerry Pizzette agrees.
As a consumer, yes, they are annoying, and that's one of the reasons I do sign up for the National Do Not Call list to eliminate junk calls.
Pizzette could also avoid those calls by moving to Indiana, if the robocall ban holds up in court.
For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
Urban trees may be earning new status in cities as more than just elements in the landscape. As Kristen Espeland reports, Louisville planners and scientists are taking stock of what trees here contribute to the economy as well as to the environment.
Ah, the sound of the forest. The urban forest, that is.
This is a lace bark elm.
On this steamy afternoon, grad student Alvin Wrench is methodically traveling the sidewalks of downtown Louisville with a clipboard and a handheld GPS. He's been trained to identify tree species and mark each tree's location, health, and size.
It's 20 feet in canopy. Does it have enough canopy space? Is there any impediments from the buildings? What is the growing space? We'll call that a well, and we'll give it 8 feet.
Wrenches and other data will go into a new database the city is creating with this inventory of downtown trees. The main idea is to paint the bigger picture. What trees are performing well and where? With that baseline, city landscapers can establish a regular maintenance schedule for each tree, depending on its species and age and condition. They can make better decisions about which trees to plant where. Public Works spokeswoman Betty Yunus says inventorying trees now should improve the way the city manages its trees over the long term.
Certainly, there's a system to it, but it's more we get a call from a concerned citizen or, you know, one of our staff sees a tree that might be have an issue, and we were dealing with it that way. This program and the management plan, which is resulting from it, allows us to be proactive instead of reactive.
University of Louisville mapping expert Bob Forbes says the data will also help the city calculate the extent to which trees are cleaning up the atmosphere and even help city arborist Mark White maximize those efforts.
There are computer programs that allow us to calculate how much oxygen are we actually creating from all these trees, pollutants are, and how much are we actually filtering out of there, so that when Mark decides what kind of trees to plant, he can look at the database and use that as a guide to future plannings.
For now, the city's tree inventory is limited to the Central Business District downtown. But what might the inventory look like in the neighborhoods? Rich neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods? University of Louisville grad student Shannon Scroggins is part of a research team trying to answer those questions. In the muggy side yard of a St. Matthew's brick home, Scroggins takes some tree measurements. She flips through a tree book to identify the species, an eastern red cedar with lacy needles and blueberry-colored cones. This is one of several plots she'll hit this summer. Scroggins says it's in one of 10 Metro Council districts chosen for the study, each having a different racial makeup, income levels, education levels, and even differing age of housing stock.
And then we're going to use those sociodemographic variables to see if there's any patterns across these council districts with what we're finding with tree cover, et cetera.
U of L professor Margaret Carrera leads the study. She's interested, for example, in whether or not rental properties have more or less tree cover than homeowner properties, and how trees have been managed or mismanaged in poor neighborhoods. Carrera's research will go beyond the city's inventory in that she's looking at the direct relationship between a tree and the building it's near.
Based on direction and the size of the tree, the size of the building, they can tell the extent to which in your latitude that tree is cooling that building in the summer.
She'll even be able to translate that into a dollar value.
If you put things into dollar signs, then planners and policymakers can compare those values with other land use options.
With two major tree surveys underway in the city, planners should very soon have a wealth of information about how to manage our urban forest. It's a sign that cities are beginning to recognize that trees do more than fill public spaces. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
When we come back, what would the fourth be without fireworks, cookouts, and red, white, and blue hammer pants? WFPL reporters look into the costs of those items and how they may or may not have changed over the last year. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, I'll speak with atheist Edwin Kagan and get his response to Dr. Albert Mohler's new book on atheism. First, this July 4th weekend, Americans face the highest gas prices in history and a tough economy all around. We wondered what that economy is doing to traditional Independence Day celebrations. Stephanie Sanders, Gabe Bullard, and Kristen Espeland went shopping for holiday supplies. We start our report with Stephanie Sanders.
If your family is anything like mine, you're having a cookout for the 4th of July. And if your mom is anything like mine, she's sending you to the store for some last-minute items. Some things never change, but something that will be different this year is how much those items will cost. So you're picking up some more cheddar cheese to top those famous hamburgers. That cheese will cost about 92 cents more per pound than it did last year. It's just another example of high gas prices trickling into costs of other goods. Kentucky Farm Bureau President Marshall Coyle says the more processing the food needs, the more energy is used to produce it, the more likely those costs get passed along to the consumer.
All of us are facing the increase in energy cost as well as the processor. You know, I mean, not only just transportation, but the increase in energy cost within those plants where the food is being processed is also up, as well as the increase in the energy cost for the grocery store.
Next on that list from Mom, corn oil for her homemade salad dressing. A 32-ounce bottle of corn oil has increased 76 cents from last year. Part of the reason is ethanol production. Agricultural economist Chad Hart with Iowa State University says early ethanol technology used all the corn kernel, and that drove up prices because some of the country's corn harvest was going strictly to ethanol.
But at the same time, we've got some plants in the ethanol industry that are looking at trying to pull the corn oil out of the distiller's grains. And as they look to add that technology, that actually will mean that with ethanol, you would get an increase in corn oil production.
And an increase in production means a decrease in prices. Hart says that technology is new and may take a few years before it's mainstream in the industry. The last thing on the list is a few more T-bone steaks. Those steaks are going to run you about 74 cents per pound more than last year, mostly because of last summer's drought. Cattle farmers couldn't get their hands on viable hay and grain to feed their herd last year, so they pared down their numbers. And Marshall Coyle says the country saw the smallest calf crop in 56 years.
The cow inventory in this country was 338,000 cows less than it was last year, and the bulk of that reduction came in the southeast region.
There are a few items that haven't increased in price since last year. So if you want to have a cookout with only cucumbers, canned tomatoes, and soy sauce, you're good to go.
After a meal and a nap, you may want to go see a fireworks show. But if crowds and gas prices are too much to handle, a backyard display could be the answer. If it's legal. And if you can afford it. I'm Gabe Bullard. I went to Phantom Fireworks in Clarksville, Indiana, to price some pyrotechnics. Store manager Darren McKinley gave me a tour.
Light one fuse and you get 100 golden pearls with glitter.
But this year, the price of golden pearls is rising.
The expense of shipping has gone up, which transfers into the cost of the products.
How much has the price gone up?
Roughly 15% across the board.
A shortage of fireworks in China, rising shipping costs, and a weakened dollar have driven prices up and supplies down. But it hasn't really affected high-end retailers or customers.
The people that are still doing well are actually buying more than ever.
A lot of people do like the big stuff, so the small stuff doesn't really sell. A lot of people like the big bang, the big show.
Ben Phillips is the manager of Celebration Fireworks, also in Clarksville. He says the big spenders are still spending, but casual buyers don't have the disposable income they once had. And while they stay home, less expensive items like firecrackers are staying on the shelves.
Probably our sales are down probably half from last year.
Which says a lot. In 2003, Americans bought nearly 221 million pounds of fireworks, mostly around the 4th of July and New Year's, which are the only times Phillips' shop is open. And many of the casual buyers who do show up have been saving up for their purchases. Mary Arnold Wood and her family made Phillips' shop a part of their road trip. They were spending big on fireworks, even after a vacation to Virginia.
Well, we budgeted for both. They like fireworks. My boys love them.
All the other customers I talked to had been budgeting most of the year for their fireworks. Clarksville vendor Ben Phillips figures many of his customers from years past are simply choosing gasoline over bottle rockets this year. Besides, most states don't even allow much beyond sparklers and snap pops, unless it's a professional display. So, if you have some spare gas and live in Kentucky, legally you'll need to go to a Hoosier's house to enjoy golden pearls of glitter in the backyard. And you may have to chip in for it.
I'm Kristen Espeland. Happy birthday, America! Oh, and in case you were worried we'd skimp on your party because of that pesky little economic downturn, don't be.
You know, when times are down, a party, you know, what better way to forget about your financial troubles, and this is a place to do it.
Tina should know. She's tidying the 4th of July party goods section at Horner's Novelty, 31,000 square feet of party goods in downtown Jeffersonville, Indiana. On offer.
red, white, and blue plates.
Hats, horns, vests, red, white, and blue bunting. We've got it in all different sizes.
Or a red, white, and blue wig.
Bubble necklaces that say, I love USA, and stars, and fireworks.
Horner's owner, Chuck Mattingly, says sales this year are even with last year's. In a conference room behind the rows of favors and decorations, he says the party supplies business seems to be recession-proof.
I've been in this business for 27 years, and I have seen that when the economy turns a little bit on the rough side, the party industry is pretty much safe from that. And my reasoning for that is we all want to party. We all want to have a good time in life.
The National Retail Federation reports that 4th of July spending on patriotic merchandise has stayed strong and even risen since 2003, with only a slight dip this year. Business consultant Kristen Givago says that may be because when money's tight, consumers tend to feel more comfortable splurging on small-ticket luxuries, and they also tend to stay home more.
I think what's happening is people are wanting to spend more on family-oriented items and relationships, and so parties are going to fall into that category.
Mattingly says he's noticed two small impacts of a weak economy, mostly tied to the price of oil and gas. Customers might call first to ask if he stocks a product rather than drive over to find out, and many of his products cost more this year than last.
The items that are definitely going up are any items that would have a oil base. A lot of our balloons, plastic items.
But again, Mattingly says that doesn't seem to deter would-be revelers. There's no stopping the barbecues, parades, or parties.
That shiny pinwheel of reporting came from Kristen Espeland, Gabe Bullard, and Stephanie Sanders. You can relive the fun and watch a video online at WFPL.org. Click on Feature Stories.
We'll be right back.
Last week, we spoke to Dr. Albert Moeller, president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, about his new book, Ism, Atheism Remix, A Christian Confronts the New Atheists. In it, Dr. Moeller talks about the rise of the so-called New Atheism that he says has an evangelistic intent, including an effort to lure Christians into the atheist fold. This week, we talk about Dr. Moeller's book with Edwin Kagan, a Northern Kentucky attorney, who's also the National Legal Director for American Atheists Incorporated. Do you agree that there is a new atheism, and exactly what is that?
I have no idea. There is no such thing. Traditionally, people like to make up definitions and then to knock down their own definitions. This is what is known in philosophy and in logical fallacy as creating a straw man argument. I will define you, and then I will refute the definition I've just made. Now, that's precisely what they're doing. I have no idea what new atheism is. This is a term that came up, and some fellow had a seminar at Harvard a couple of years ago and talked about it, and then it got picked up and has been referred to Dawkins, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, and others. But I think it's an absurdity. There's nothing whatsoever new about atheism. Atheism is merely the fact that one does not believe in a God. It does not assert that there is no God, at least I don't think sane atheism should. I certainly do not, because you can't prove that. It's merely a statement, I do not believe in a God. Now, there's nothing new about that. That's been going on since the time of the ancient Greeks. The early Christians were referred to as atheists by the Romans because they denied the gods of Rome. And every time I have a debate or a talk on this subject, I generally ask the audience to hold up their hands. How many believe in Thor? How many in Zeus? How many in Isis? Osiris? Poseidon? Well, none of them do, but many of them believe in Jehovah, the war god of the Hebrews. Now, I'm merely an atheist as to one more God than they are. They are atheists as to Odin, as to Zeus, as to Isis. They are atheists in rejecting acceptance of that deity. They don't believe in that deity. And that's all atheism really is, and it frightens the whatever out of people like Dr. Moeller and others who appear to want to control others through their religion. They want to use the belief system as a means of power, money, and control. And so it has always been. Someone said sarcastically once that the priesthood started when the first con artist met the first fool. I think that may be a bit harsh, but nevertheless, why not just leave atheists alone? They don't believe? Okay, fine. You do. Just go on and assume that you're going to heaven and they're going to hell and let it go at that.
Do you think that, or is there an organized effort, as Dr. Moeller contends, to convert people to atheism?
Oh, of course not. Nobody's trying to convert anybody to anything. Atheism, it's like, if you believe in wellness over illness, are you trying to convert people to wellness? No, of course not. Atheism is the absence of a belief. I and Richard Dawkins and others think many people might be a lot happier if they were not pressed down, if you were, controlled by a religious system or the necessity of believing in rewards and punishment, that they would be happier, better adjusted people if they tried to live for life in this world rather than for life in some imaginary, wish-fulfilling, supernatural afterlife. Atheists generally reject an afterlife, but no, nobody. Atheism is not a religion, as some have tried to maintain. It's quite the opposite.
I'd like to get a sense of the numbers. I think Dr. Moeller mentioned that there's been a surge, I believe was the word he used, excuse me, in the number of atheists. Is that the case in Kentucky and the rest of the country?
I would certainly hope so, but I haven't noticed that. We figure there might be about 13% who are non-believers. Now, it has a lot to do with how you define the question, how you set out your questionnaire. I truly believe there are an awful lot of more closet atheists than anyone knows about, people who simply have not had the a courage, if you will, to come out of the closet, so to speak, and say that I do not believe. I daily, in my capacity as National Legal Director for American Atheists, get complaints from all over the country of schools run by public funds, of city councils, of all sorts of improper places trying to place religion into public life where it has no business to be. There are public schools that even give courses to the kids on how to convert your parents so they don't go to hell. There are unlawful Bible readings, unlawful prayers given over the loudspeaker, and they don't care what the law is because they see that they have a higher duty, and that higher duty compels them to break the law. Well, that's why we have the First Amendment, because everybody thinks their higher religious duty lets them break the law and ignore the rights of everyone else. And it's very true that Christianity is a majority religion in the United States. So you don't need a Bill of Rights to protect the majority. The majority do quite well on their own. You need the Bill of Rights to protect the minority. And all they have to do is simply follow the law. They can have all the prayers, all the Ten Commandments posted in their homes, churches, synagogues, private organizations they want with no complaint from anyone. In fact, we would defend their right to do it, and we have defended their right to do it. But when they invade the public forum and try to use public funds to push their message, they run afoul of the law and meet our legal department. Answers in Genesis, for example, has an absolute right to have their creation museum, their museum of nonsense. They can argue that things fall off if they like, as long as they don't use public funds to do it. But as soon as they try to get state funding for this, or to try to have it taught in public schools, or have busloads of children, yellow buses of the same type used to take people to watch The Passion of the Christ, hauling them to the Creation Museum, they will face a lawsuit. And as long as we are a free nation with the First Amendment and the other guarantees, we're going to be okay. What's scary is not the number of atheists that appear to be coming out, it's the number of people who think it's perfectly okay to impose religion on others in public forums. That's what's frightening.
That was Edwin Kagan, National Legal Director for American Atheists Incorporated, and an attorney in Northern Kentucky. More information about Kagan, American Atheists, and Dr. Albert Mohler's book is available at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Stephanie Sanders speaks with the producer of the 3D feature film, Journey to the Center of the Earth. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. If you go see Journey to the Center of the Earth next weekend, at some theaters you'll be handed a piece of equipment for viewing the film, 3D glasses. Charlotte Huggins is one of the leading producers for 3D filmmaking in Hollywood and has worked for the last 4 years on the movie, which stars Brendan Fraser. Stephanie Sanders talked to Huggins about Journey, the future of 3D movies, and her
connections to Louisville. Can you tell me what they are?
I have many connections to Louisville. In fact, I've got a whole entire house filled with people from Louisville. Both my brothers and their wives and their families live in Louisville. And my, I went to school at U of L for a while. I didn't graduate from there, but I went to school there for a year. And, my family, my parents lived there for many, many years, probably 15 years. And they since moved to Kansas City. But, yes, I have my nieces here from Louisville, and my sister-in-law is here. They came to the premiere.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you study at U of L?
I was a freshman in college. I studied French Lit.
Oh.
Yes, actually my mom got her master's degree from U of L, and she taught English literature, and my two oldest nieces go to school there now.
Cool. So, and you've made your way through, different educational places. You've studied abroad and kind of paid your dues in Hollywood, and now you're a 3D producer in Hollywood. I mean, what exactly does that mean?
What that means is many, many years ago, I had been doing television. I did Hunter television show for NBC, wrote Hunter, and then moved from that into visual effects and did big commercials, like Super Bowl commercials, and really, $5-7 million commercials producing them. And then I had children, and I started thinking, you know what? It's fun to do commercials. You learn a lot. It's really exciting, and the pace is very quick because you're moving through the productions very quickly. But at the end of the day, I thought I'd like to do something that, I could show my kids and that would be fun for them. And so I got into making IMAX movies and did that for many years. And as IMAX transitioned from sort of 2D to primarily 3D movies, I found myself making sort of 3D IMAX movies and loved it. Loved the experience, loved going in the theater and watching them. And so I became kind of an expert in the technology and the process and the creative process that differentiates a traditional 2D movie from a 3D movie. And as that has been moved into feature filmmaking, I've been, sort of helping lead the way.
And that's kind of new, too, right, that it's moving into feature films?
Oh, yeah. It's not new, I should say. It's a revival. There have been several, 3D revivals. There was one in the sort of late 40s, and then again in the 70s, with Jaws 3D and that sort of thing. And then it never lasts. It has never lasted in the past because the technology was actually pretty difficult to create on set. So it was like really difficult to make a 3D movie, and it was even worse to project a 3D movie in a theater because there was no real way to do that with any level of quality. But the digital revolution has completely transformed both aspects of it. We can now make a 3D movie fairly simply. The technology is facile. The people know how to use it, and the actors and the directors and the creators can sort of relax and think about making the movie, as opposed to think about the technology. And then in the theaters, we have digital projection, which creates an environment for easy, watchable 3D.
So if that is true, then do you think that maybe this time around when 3D is happening again in feature films, that maybe it won't go away? Maybe it'll become even more popular, maybe become the mainstay of filmmaking?
I think it has a very good likelihood of becoming another production tool. In other words, movies used to be black and white and silent, of course, and then sound came along, and it was just another department. You sort of didn't think about the idea of sound. It just became something that you did automatically. But you don't always have to use sound, and many movies use very, silent periods in a movie or very quiet periods to emphasize certain things or make them scarier or make them seem, you know, have certain emotion. So you can now use sound however you want. Then color came along with, you know, Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz and things like that. And then color became something you can just use. You don't always have to use color, but typically you do, and it's just something that people think of as the normal course of making a movie. And now I think 3D will be the same way. It's not that we will make 3D movies. It's that we'll make movies in 3D.
So maybe this is going to be a really silly question. Is this something that when I go to see a 3D movie, I'm going to wear the glasses?
Oh, yeah. You have to wear the glasses. somebody asked me the other day, we had the premiere of Journey last Sunday, and someone asked me the other day, you know, when are they going to make the movie? This was a guy from Paris, a reporter from Paris. He said, when are they going to make the glasses, you know, more chic, more cool? And I said, well, you know, it is a matter of time, because as more and more 3D movies come out, the glasses are already getting better and better.
Sure, so we could all have, like, our designer 3D glasses.
Yes, exactly. If you haven't been to a 3D movie recently, even, I would say, in the last, year, you will be surprised, I think, happily surprised at how comfortable the glasses are, how they fold up, they're heavy, they're not like the paper glasses with the red blue filters. They have polarized filters in them, and you really can't even tell you're wearing them. So it's a really different kind of 3D experience.
And I'm assuming, by the way you responded, that those glasses are kind of inherent to the way 3D works, in that there'll never be a time that we move away from needing the glasses.
There will be a time. In fact, the time is upon us. On a smaller scale, there are 3D screens and monitors from Sanyo, Samsung, Mitsubishi, Panasonic. They're all making glasses-free 3D monitors. You'll start to see them. They're already rolling out around the world as 3D product becomes more available. And they are quite tricky technologically, but that, of course, becomes, you know, easier and easier as technology, you know, advances so rapidly. The key now will be, how do you get a giant screen in 3D, in glasses-free 3D? But I think it's a matter of time. Whether that time is, you know, 3 years, 5 years, or 10 years, technology moves so quickly, it's hard for me to tell. But, no, I think there will be a time where we actually have glasses-free 3D projection.
So let's talk a little bit about Journey to the Center of the Earth. How did you get involved with that project?
The Journey to the Center of the Earth was a script that Walden Media, who did, you know, Bridge to Terabithia and the Narnia movies, they take novels and they, you know, and particularly, you know, historically successful and good, you know, sort of children's literature, and make them into movies. So they had on their slate of films in development Journey to the Center of the Earth, which they wanted to make into a feature film. And they were sort of struggling with how to get an angle on it to make it, you know, to make it an interesting movie. And we went in at that time, my business partner, four and a half years ago, read about this and said this would make an excellent 3D feature film, because the environment is inherent for 3D. I mean, you go to a place that you've never been and that you'll never go, and that makes for a great 3D experience. So we went to Walden. They had already made two 3D movies with Jim Cameron, two 3D IMAX movies, and so they were familiar with 3D. I didn't have to educate them about 3D. That was great. They embraced the idea, and we developed it together. I worked with Walden for almost two years, getting the movie greenlit, and then the last 2 years making the movie.
So what exactly are you running the sort of the technological side of the production, or what exactly was your role with Journey?
I'm the producer of the movie, and as the producer, I know far from the running the technical side. What I do is help to find and bring together, you know, the best team possible, and then, you know, work with the director mostly to, you know, help him. Eric Brevig is the director, to help him realize his vision. He had a wonderful vision for the movie. Work with him to, you know, help cast the movie and rewrite the script and that sort of thing. And then also to bring the technology team together. So it's really a, you know, I would say it's like a 33,000 feet sort of job.
Mm-hmm.
I try to not to think about too much about the details and concentrate on, you know, what's going to be on the screen.
And how did it turn out? Did it turn out, I guess, the way you thought it would 4.5 years ago?
you know, I dare say it exceeded my expectations. It was a very, you know, tough production because we were blazing a lot of trails using cameras that actually were being machined right before we were shooting with them, and equipment and things that had, you know, never been tried, and that was difficult. We had amazing, great people from both Walden and New Line, which helped a lot. But having two studios, you know, is a considerable amount of work, because you have to listen to both and answer to both, and so that was, you know, it was a difficult production in many ways. Brendan Fraser was terrific and wonderful to work with, and I think at the end of the day, the relationship between Brendan, Josh, and Anita, the three leads in the movie, is so much fun. That the fact that the visuals are really cool and the movie is really fast paced and funny, and Eric, you know, never lets the movie sort of take itself too seriously. I mean, after all, we're in the center of the earth, right? And so he lets that happen. But at the end of the day, you really like watching those three people.
Mm. So I know you've recently gone to the premiere, and it's opening nationwide on July 11th. Is it too soon to ask you what you're going to work on next?
Well, I have another movie coming out August 8th. So as soon as we give birth to Journey to the Center of the Earth, which I am so looking forward to doing, because so far the reaction has been really positive. And you know, let's we're keeping our fingers tightly crossed that people across the country, you know, come out and see the movie. Once that movie comes out, then I will sort of turn my attention to Fly Me to the Moon, which comes out August 8th, and is a G-rated family picture, animated picture for kids, and it's going to be fun. So I kind of turn my attention to that and launch Fly Me to the Moon, which is also 3D, by the way.
Good luck with your two summer
big
films
summer.
Coming
big
out.
Summer for 3D.
Sure. All right. Thanks for talking to us, Charlotte. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Stephanie. It's wonderful talking to you.
Journey to the Center of the Earth comes out Friday. You can learn more about 3D films at our website, WFPL.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky 40202, or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.